Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. JD, Ailish, and Blake. It's back.
Remember him?
Triumvirate. Blake Murphy jumps on, joins us now live from Drumbo, Ontario, home of the food land. Home of.
No, the food land is air.
Oh, wait. We got to try again.
Oh,
Blake
you're sounding
Murphy.
Rough,
your
Blake.
Your sound is rough. They did the thing to you again. They did the thing to you, so we'll reset that. We'll let you and Josh get that sorted. But yes, the food land is air, which means that we don't know what Drumbo has got in store for
Drumbo
us.
Drumbo will have nothing open, not even like a backup option on Canada Day.
Oh, I don't think that there's backup options.
There's one store.
I don't think
the local cornfield. The local farmer's market.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not buying that right now. Does Blake have the audio figured out yet, Josh, or what? What's going on? Nope, that's not it either. That's certainly not it. Boy, this is a real crack squad we got going on here today.
We're mailing it in. It's the long weekend,
yeah,
baby.
Josh is just like, I'm not doing things today. Blake's just like, what do you think's happening? Josh already into long weekend, or Blake being like, Blake, you were on air for that, if that's what you would like to know. we did hear your little Blake's messaging off of the side chat. we could hear of Josh Malin or Blake, like, faking connection
issues.
You know, issues
Blake
so
would never miss an
to
opportunity
bed.
To work and to be on air and to have his voice heard around the sound waves and the TV waves and everything. So that we know it's one way here.
Yeah.
You think I woke up at 7 a.m.?
That's
just
him.
To mess with you guys.
Well, it was Josh. Answer is there. Is Josh a hot seat for you going into the weekend? Like, we know you were mailed in. We know you didn't check Blake's audio right. Like, it's okay, buddy. Canada weekend affects us all differently. Blake Murphy joins us right now. I've been texting a lot with you over the last couple of days with the Jalen Brunson stuff kind of coming down the pipeline, right? I'm going, what am I missing with Jalen Brunson? Like, I like many of you out there, have seen a decent chunk of this guy because we watch Luka Doncic, and people are invested in seeing what Luka does. But the story around Luka was, this guy doesn't have enough help. That has been, like, the Luka story for the last couple of years. And I think that we're going to see this evolve, like the way that we talk about what help means in the NBA over the next coming seasons, after what we saw with the Boston Celtics, what we've seen with the Golden State Warriors, in that the importance of having depth and versatility, and, you know, that it isn't just like the old model of try and go get three superstar players and who cares about the bench. Like, I think that There's always going to be that in the NBA. There's always going to be teams that pursue that in the NBA if they're given the opportunity to do so. But that team building in general, I get the sense from following the league closely and from what we've seen the last couple of years that teams are not going to prioritize it as much, and that handing over the car keys to superstars that might want out in a couple of years, it's going to be kind of less player, like, we reached a tipping point with player empowerment, and I don't think that we're going back. I think that we're going more towards trying to insulate yourself from these things. So the Mavericks never had a secondary star. No one ever thought Jalen Brunson was a secondary star. There were moments in that series last year when they beat Phoenix where Dorian Finney-Smith was their second most important player. And so I guess I'm just going to start with the Jalen Brunson thing, and how I'll get there in terms of how it relates to Fred in a second, but what is your theory in terms of why he has become such a huge commodity here? Because now we're not only just talking about the Knicks doing something where they're giving him a ton of money. The Mavericks don't appear to have a walking away point when it comes to the money that they'll give him. And now the Miami Heat have entered the conversation where they're looking at this and going, yeah, we'll make a trade and we'll part with assets to acquire this player.
Well, here's the big thing is this free class is historically light. So if you are a team that is looking to improve, you've basically got three of that. And it's internal development, it's overpay for a fringy free agent, or it's trade. And then you have kind of a 2B where Detroit has rented a cap space to acquire more picks and get rotation pieces they could flip again later. So
we got to disconnect with you again, Blake. I think this one's on you, though. This one might be your internet because you're glitchy.
That was the Jumbo internet for sure.
Yeah, that was a Jumbo. Switch to...
What if we call him like a phone call?
Yeah, like a pure guest.
You know those things, like a pure guest, like on a telephone.
No. I think that the first one goes on Josh, like we said. Josh, hot seat. Number two is Jumbo Internet. Number three, we're gonna see if Jumbo has data.
there's no way Jumbo has data.
You don't think Jumbo has data?
That's a stretch. I think we should just call him like a regular guest.
Okay. Well, that'll be our next attempt here with Blake Murphy. Because, yeah, I do want to talk to Blake about this. And there is a lot of stuff that I think Blake is kind of like uniquely situated to understand in terms of what's going on with Fred VanVleet. Because, yeah, the Brunson thing, I think, yes, it's not a deep free agent class. There aren't a ton of names that people can pursue and go after. I think it is an indicator that guys like Bradley Beal and James Harden are going to be returning to their situations, that those guys are not actually free agents. Although I do wonder why a team like the Knicks, if they were going to be going all in on a guy like Jalen Brunson, wouldn't be trying a little bit harder to go after somebody like Bradley Beal. It might even just tell you, though, it might even be a good indicator as to what the market is. What the market is for guys like Bradley Beal and James Harden. Hey, Blake, I know we got you back now. All I was saying there is just simply that what do you think the market is? Do you think that this is an indicator market-wise that guys like Harden and Beal, there's just no chance that they're actually going to leave their situations? Because you would think that teams like a team like the Knicks, especially like a group like that that's so intent on getting a splashy star, or even a team like Miami where they're usually better at taking players and getting the best out of them, that those two organizations would be looking at guys like that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, you know, Brunson has a little bit the benefit of age on his side, where he's 25 right now, and you can see him, you know, pairing with R.J. Barrett and the rest of that core moving forward. Now, it's the most Knicks thing ever that now, like, it's a weird offseason to do it. It's a weird player to target. Like, why didn't you do this with Fred VanVleet when Fred VanVleet was a free agent and cheaper not that long ago? But, yeah, like, most of the reporting is that Harden is going to re-up in Philly on a more team-friendly deal, and Beal's staying in Washington anyway. Zach LaVine's kind of the interesting one where, you know, he screams Knicks, like the type of guy that the Knicks would have gone after and moved heaven and earth for. So, you know, maybe they just didn't see the fit with RJ as much. But honestly, you look through the top free agent list, and it's basically, you know who's right after Jalen Brunson on John Hollinger's list of free agents? Chris Boucher. That's what this free agent class looks like. So the Knicks doing a lot of that, it's hard.
I think Hollinger, I agree that it's not the deepest class, but I disagree with Hollinger's assessment of this class. I can name you other free agents I like more than Chris Boucher.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it's not a great free agent class. And then the other hard part in terms of extrapolating the Brunson thing to the rest of the market, I don't know that it's a great indicator because it's the Knicks, right? It's like when the Kings do something, you don't think, well, that's where the league is going. I think in the Knicks case, they got very tunnel visioned with this Jalen Brunson thing. It sounds like they moved a lot of rotation caliber players and juggled a lot of things to create cap space for Brunson before they knew they had him for sure. So the funniest possible outcome for the offseason now is the Knicks don't get Jalen Brunson and they're stuck there with nothing. But to get back to your original question, I don't think there's a ton of market signal about this beyond it being a weak class. But certainly if you're Fred VanVleet, you're licking your chops for next time you hit the market.
Okay, well, that's leads me to kind of the next thing. Is I'm like, okay, well, what do you really care about with the Jalen Brunson story? And I'm like, well, not much, but if you, which you have, I've been saying for forever, like before Fred entered free agency last time, I was nervous because I thought that this was going to happen with Fred VanVleet, with the Detroit Pistons and with the New York Knicks, that these two teams were going to say, you know what, we're going to overpay for a free agent here in Fred, but he fits the culture, He's a really good player. We can bring him in on a non-max deal, and he will end up actually having some impact on not only like our guys getting better, not only us building up something from the ground, but also potentially, like, I think Fred is someone who, in the right situation, guys would want to play with. Like, I don't think that Fred VanVleet, it fits the category of guys really have to think about it long and hard and go, well, how would I fit next to Fred, right?
No, do you agree with that? Yeah, I do agree with that, and I think your point earlier about Luka Doncic as an example of, well, teams might be getting away from the three stars model and they want smart complementary pieces around a kind of heliocentric star. Fred VanVleet's kind of the optimal of that, right? Like, we exactly. saw it a little bit with Kawhi Leonard, and obviously not at the same scale, but what did we say all year? When did the Raptors' offense look its best? When the ball was in Pascal Siakam's hands and Fred VanVleet was kind of that, yes, he played a lot of point guard still, but you're leveraging the fact that he shoots 40% on 10 threes a game and he can play defense. So I do think he is one of the most portable secondary guys that there are in the league. So when you look ahead to what Fred VanVleet's free agent market could be like, I think it's one of those ones where, yes, 2 years ago when he re-upped, it was all the kind of young up-and-coming teams should be after him as a culture builder and a guy who fits the timeline. And now it's going to be any good team is going to be in on Fred VanVleet. Like, you can already pencil in that Miami wants Fred VanVleet whenever he does become a free agent. It's just he'll be a guy that smart teams go after as a complementary kind of 2B or 3.
Okay, well, again, this brings me to the thing is, I think that the Knicks missed out on Fred. They knew their mistake, and now they're trying to make up for it by signing a different version-ish of Fred. Jalen Brunson isn't Fred, but they have a lot of similarities. Like, their game has similarities. Brunson, obviously, like, the bigger guy who, you could disagree. I would say that debating those two players, though, in terms of who you'd rather have for the next 3 years, like, they would actually be the two guys that you would compare with one another. Like, Fred has more pedigree. Fred has done more in his career. Fred is the better shooter. Fred is probably still the better defender. But Brunson, in a lot of different categories, I don't think that you could really say, like, there's a real massive material divide between the two guys. Like, they're both kind of on that fringe of, if they were on the right team, they could make an all-star team. But if they're the isolation top-end guy, they're not that. They're like, I don't know, somewhere around the top 10 point guards in the NBA, right? Like, this fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. And okay. Brunson, you know, you laid out the advantages younger. VanVleet has. Brunson's a little younger, and he's a better finisher. Like, he's close to a 70% finisher most years around the rim, which is, you know, he doesn't get there at high volume, but that's been the shortcoming in Fred's profile. So that balances out at least a little bit of the shooting. He pressures the rim in a different way and a different dynamic than Fred does. I still think Fred's better, but they're very close comparables.
Yeah, I think that Fred might be better right now, but I think that if you were offering me the next 4 years of both players, I would probably take Brunson, given Fred's inability to stay healthy, some of what we saw in the playoffs this year, and the stuff at the rim. And the fact that Jalen Brunson is not like a bad three-point shooter, he's not a liability there. Either way,
37%.
Either way, I think that the two guys are close. My point with this, though, is that a lot of people are looking at this Knicks contract and the idea that they're going to pay Jalen Brunson this much. And you're right. Part of this is the fact that the Knicks are not only paying him, that they're shuffling deck chairs to acquire him, right? Like, that they're going, we're willing to trade assets. Like, we'll give up the 13th pick in the draft to get off of a bad contract in order to bring this guy in. Like, this isn't just in a vacuum. But most of the NBA is in agreement that this is becoming too much money for Jalen Brunson. And if we agree that this is not, or that this might be too much money for Jalen Brunson, what does this say about a potential extension for Fred VanVleet, who's looking at, apparently, according to Jake Fisher, who, by the way, was like the first person I saw that had the Spurs-Hawks deal like down to a T, he's got this, that the Raptors and Fred VanVleet appear headed towards a contract extension that could approach 4 years and over $110 million. And then we'll get to the Thad Young piece of that later.
Yeah, so the max extension Fred can sign right now, he could opt out of his final year, sign a four-year $114.2 million extension. That's the number that I've heard. He could also pick up that option and sign a three-year $89 million extension. They come out to almost the same. It's just a matter of how they want to chop it up. I had a good chat with Jake Fisher the other day, actually, about this and some of the other Raptors stuff. I think it's real. I think you look at what Jalen Brunson's headed for, and there's a bit of a gap here in that we're talking about a max for Jalen Brunson, and that is going to be north of $31 million to start, and it's going to be escalating. Like Jalen Brunson's looking at 4 years, $140 million. So a notable difference there. But yeah, it's a big money. Like you're talking about 28 per year on a Fred extension. It's a lot. Now the way the cap has exploded, again, like it's going up higher than expectations, is actually projected now to go up the maximum allowable, like when they put these kind of post-pandemic rises on it, and it said it would rise between 3 to 10%. It's right at the top cap of that, and that doesn't affect Fred's extension. So what that does effectively is it means that $28.5 million for Fred is now a smaller percentage. So you're not worried about it as much. It actually helps with a Fred extension. But yeah, you're going to have to get comfortable with the fact that you're going to pay him $28-29 million a year on that extension, because if you don't, he's going to look at the Jalen Brunson thing, and he's going to look 1 year ahead to free agency, and he's going to, I mean, would it shock you guys if Fred VanVleet bet on himself and kind of thought that 1 year from now he could get 30 plus million on the market? That wouldn't surprise me at all. And he's going to have a higher max by that point as well.
Yeah, okay, so this is where I'm at with it, and this is what I want to talk to you about. And you know I get in trouble when I do my hypotheticals here, especially when they involve Raptors.
Especially your Fred, your Fred hypotheticals.
Well, if Fred VanVleet told me that, like, I'll bet on myself, and you still have this 1 year left, I would say that's fine. We will take that risk, because here's the thing. Fred, in his career, these are the games played since 2019. Uh-huh. 64, 54, 52, 65. He's in his age 28 season. Like you mentioned, the Jalen Brunson thing. Jalen Brunson is 25 years old and he's entering this free agency period. Like, yep. That has to count for something. That Fred has not been able to stay healthy. I don't think that, like, when we're talking about that finishing profile at the rim, that has been a thing for Fred VanVleet for quite some time now, and I don't think that that's going to, like, improve with age, right? Like, Jalen Brunson the last two seasons, 68 games and 79 games played. Not the same track record of history, not the same miles on the tires. And again, I'm looking at this through, like, a kind of a purely, this is what you have to do in the NBA. This is what you have to do with a market like Toronto, where everything matters, right? Every little detail matters. I'm not sure that it actually is the smartest thing to do is to give Fred VanVleet that 4 year, you know, legacy contract that's based off of a number of Jalen Brunson, just because you can make the case that this very moment he is better than Jalen Brunson. I would say that if I'm the Raptors, you have to at least think about two things before you sign that extension. And both of them are tough, and neither of them I would expect to come to fruition, because, again, you always usually want certainty with these players, and they'll look at it and say, well, like, they'll justify it with those cap numbers and those percentages and whatever. Like, they're not going to try to fight with Fred VanVleet or make it acrimonious. They're going to want to keep their culture intact. There's a lot of reasons to extend Fred, okay? So I don't want to act like this is me saying, oh, don't give Fred VanVleet any money. But there would be two things for me. One is, what is really the harm of asking him to just play out his contract the way that the contract is, and then just go into free agency with him next year and offer him the most competitive offer, knowing that, like, we do have a good team, he does have a good role here, there's a lot of different stuff. And two, do you not at least have to do the mental exercise of, if this is what Jalen Brunson costs in free agency, what could you get for Fred in a trade? And is he not the actual guy that you would look at in terms of quote-unquote timeline pieces? Because, like, I think Siakam's going to age better than Fred. And Siakam shows that he can stay healthier than Fred. And we've always talked about this timeline thing as, like, a Siakam versus Scotty thing, and never really put Fred in that conversation. And so, yeah, I just think, would the Raptors even look at stuff like that? Or would you even look at stuff like that?
So in terms of the first one, the downside to that is, so right now Fred's max extension is based on his current contract, not the cap. If you let him play it out and go to free agency, suddenly his theoretical max is way, way higher. Yep. And then you're negotiating in a wider band of outcomes with the possibility that another team comes in. So this is, you know, that's the trade-off there. That's the risk you take. In terms of number two, yeah, I mean, I think you're at a point as a franchise where you've got to explore everything. I think they value Fred for a lot more than just his on-court stuff. I think the culture building, the leadership is real. I think the show guys that you reward, your own homegrown guys, is real. And I think We'll see how this year goes in terms of managing his minutes a little better and stuff like that. Generally, the guys who shoot at the level of Fred do age a little more gracefully. But maybe that, you know, you lose a little bit of confidence in that based on the size or something like that.
The injury history has to be mentioned here. Like, cannot stay
now,
healthy.
I just wonder if that goes hand in hand with the workload, where we need to see a season of him averaging only 30 minutes a game or 32 minutes a game. But those are all real considerations. And this is the what's always going to be the difficult part about being kind of in the middle like the Raptors are. And they're in the middle with a bullet. They're going in the right direction with their youth and how they've built and stuff like that. But you have to make hard decisions because you don't have a clear path out of the middle, even with that bullet. So you do have to have those conversations and look at those things. I can't imagine a scenario. Well, I can imagine it, but it's an unlikely scenario where whatever the offer would be outweighs all the things the Raptors love about Fred from a player standpoint, from a organizational standpoint. And honestly, I don't think they're going to balk at the extension. Like, I think you got to wrap your head around it, because I think it's fairly likely it gets done.
Yeah, no, I've already accepted that it is done. What I think is actually just simply the more prudent move, though, is to sign that extension and then actually also be thinking about what a trade could look like. I just look at this and say, man, DeJounte Murray, I love DeJounte Murray. This to me is very much a win-win trade, the Murray trade yesterday, where I looked at it and said, this is good for both organizations. Like, there's a bit of a resetting of the timeline with the Spurs. You look at all their draft picks right now, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And they draft so well, it's terrifying.
Exactly, right? So it's like the Spurs right now, they have all their own picks. They have the Charlotte pick in 2023. I wrote it down here somewhere, but it's like lengthy. It's very, very lengthy in terms of what the Spurs have right now in the coffers. Two unprotected picks right now, again, from the Hawks. Who knows what that could look like in 2027. But that just kind of tells you, again, what the guard market is right now. Like, some of these teams that really want to win and kind of take that next step. And I'm looking at it and thinking, okay, so Scotty Barnes is your point guard. Siakam is your other guy. How do you feel about, an aging Fred as that sort of shooting guard player? If you're picking him, I just don't know if you have room cap-wise to keep both Fred VanVleet and Gary Trent Jr. as your two, like, these are the other guards. Can you make up with that with the rest of the size that you have? I'm always a believer in trying to find value for your organization, at least explore the value for your organization. And if there's something that's highly coveted in a market and you can get surplus value on it, what is Fred's quote-unquote impact? Like, all those things the Raptors like about him, what does that become if you're talking about being able to acquire multiple unprotected first-round picks from an organization, or bringing in some younger guys that you might be able to develop and fit more seamlessly next to a guy like Scotty Barnes over the next couple of years? I think what it really has to come down to is, do you think the Raptors have a window where that Fred VanVleet extension happens and they can win? Because if you do, then you re-sign him. If you don't, I think you have to explore the trade.
Yeah, I mean, you have to explore all these things. It's where you're at as a, like, in your kind of organizational build and your development curve. Just one note, like, if they extend him, they can't trade him for 6 months.
Yep.
But that's still before the deadline, right? Like, he can be extended July 8th, so you could still trade him in January or whatever. I think if you extend him, with the idea that, like you just laid out, you can win with this core and you can continue to add at the fringes and massage things. And yes, maybe a Gary Trent or an OG gets you into a discussion for someone else later. But I think I don't know. I've got the impression that they think they're not that far away. Maybe not championship contention far away, but like, if we were to stack up the Eastern Conference the way it looks today, they're closer to the top than they are to the play-in from last year. That's the sense that I get in terms of their confidence level, of their proximity there. So, look, these are all things they're discussing. That, and if Max Holloway can win on the weekend, it's a big talking point for the front office. You do have to explore all that stuff. You wouldn't be doing your job if you were a GM and you look at DeJounte Murray getting three picks and a pick swap, and you didn't look at Jalen Brunson getting $30-35 million and think, well, could we use this differently? I just think at the end of the day, they're going to decide, no, we can't use it differently. We value Fred too highly.
I'm torn on it, I'll be honest, because I don't know. I think that Fred aging into this contract well and looking at this deal and saying, wow, that was a real success, is it's hard to envision. And I'm not a big believer in the workload thing with Fred. And even if you are a big believer in the workload thing with Fred, that tells you something about the contract extension he's getting. Is that, well, we need to make sure we massage his minutes in his late 20s already. He's 6 feet tall, and you saw the limitations of what his offensive game can be in a series against the Sixers this year where the shot's not dropping, right? Like, if the pull-up three is not dropping, then the rest of the offense can kind of fall apart pretty quickly for that guy. Even in a league where it's like you hunt matchups, if Fred loses a step at his size, that step is going to be pretty significant. So I guess, like, kind of the point I'm making here is that I'm like, from the negative side, I would say Fred right now, being able to trade him for a massive asset boon, like the thing that we were talking about with OG Anunoby, I don't know why he's sort of been absent from this conversation when sometimes it feels like he's the most obvious guy. Like, I'd rather have OG Anunoby under contract for the next 4 years than Fred. I would rather have Pascal Siakam on a contract for the next 4 years than Fred. And yet, whenever we do these exercises of, like, the timeline, they usually involve trading one of those two guys and keeping Fred and Scotty. And that part of it I don't really get. The second part, though, is the positive, and where I go I'm torn, is that I think that a lot of the reason why the Celtics had success this year and the Warriors is continuity and being able to identify, like, you have core pieces that you don't move off of, and you constantly just try to tinker around the edges, and you try to find those depth pieces, you try to hit on the draft, and you hope that that ends up lining up with the core. And I think that is the Raptors' best chance of success. I can't help but wonder what exactly could come back for Fred and whether or not, that window is going to be 2 or 3 years, because I think that's going to be Fred's best window, is 2 or 3 years. Once you start getting into the four and into those 30 years, I just have a tougher time projecting out that way.
Yeah, and look, it's, some people have a different appetite for draft picks and kicking the can down the line competitively than other people.
Have a lot of that.
Exactly. And you're right. The Celtics are a helpful example. even the Warriors. The Warriors have high-end star talent, and that was the root of their first couple championships. But I talked to Nick Nurse about this last week on the Raptors show, about that value of continuity, especially when you play a defense as complex as the Raptors do. There's a real, like, we've seen it year after year, that the new guys take a while to get comfortable. Like, Precious Achiuwa didn't look like the guy we're all high on now until midway or two-thirds the way through the season last year. There's a real cost to that, and if they think they're close at all, they're going to put a value on that. So, JD, I don't think anything you're saying is wrong. I think you have to explore all this stuff. I just think the Raptors think they're not a crazy distance away, and Fred VanVleet's a really big part of that.
So I don't either. I keep looking at the landscape and going, well, how realistic is it that the Raptors bring back a team where, and I know that we've done the thing where we ask too much of, like, OG Anunoby's improvement year over year, and we'll probably end up doing that with Scotty Barnes to a degree, but I think that what Siakam unlocked this year is very real, and him being able to get over that playoff moment and then find success is probably, like, even a little under-discussed in terms of what ended up happening out of that postseason series. But you come back with, like, this formula of over a year, a more confident Scotty Barnes, maybe a reinvigorated OG Anunoby, hopefully a healthier OG Anunoby and a healthier Fred, and I think you've got something there. But the problem that I have with them is that, how do you improve the depth? Because I really like that core, and I really think that that core can just compete with just about anybody. Like, we've seen them give the Celtics a tough time. We've seen them give Milwaukee a tough time. I still think that they are, like, a really, really tough out for a lot of these groups. But what the Raptors don't have is, like, that depth. And the idea that, you know, Christian Coloco is going to come in here and, like, materially change the center position in year one is a huge reach. I still don't like Kem Birch. I like what we saw from Precious Achiuwa, but it still doesn't identify one of the issues that they had last year, which is, like, interior defense. And they still need more guard depth. Like, it's weird because now I actually like the core, but I don't see a timeline where the Raptors can add a bunch of, like, really good depth pieces that help them in all the ways that they need to help them. Like, where are they going to be able to get all that stuff?
I mean, you split the mid-level across 400 guys. This is a challenge for the front office, and it's a bit of a you know, it's a bit of a test for them because they, the early years of this franchise on the come up under this front office was you keep finding guys who are undervalued and getting more out of them. You keep finding undrafted or underdrafted guys and they can contribute in meaningful ways. And they've still been able to do that and turn a 15th man into a 12th man. But what they haven't been able to do as much the last couple of years is find guys who can jump into a seventh, eighth man role and develop guys into that. Now, Precious Achiuwa could be that, but he was also a borderline lottery pick a year before they got him. I don't know that he counts there. So the challenge is on them to, you know, it's really funny to look at who's high on the market this year. It's like, oh, Malik Monk and Isaiah Hartenstein are going to get a ton of money. Like, yeah, those are the guys you should have been after last year. You're not supposed to chase those guys. If you're the Raptors, you're supposed to be the team that finds the Malik Monk and Isaiah Hartenstein before they become expensive. Yep. So that's the challenge for that front office this offseason especially is because, look, if they, I know we're running out of time to do the Thad and Chris Boucher thing. If they bring those guys back, that's 13 roster spots basically penciled in. So you're not – it's not only a cap flexibility thing where all you have to use is the mid-level. It's also a you're running out of roster spots. So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. There's all the chatter. Like Mark Stein and Jake Fisher had a Spaces last night or a live stream last night, and the chatter remains the Raptors are more interested in centers than anything else. Yeah. I think that's off a little bit. I think I'd be leaning toward perimeter help here for a lot of the things you just discussed in talking about Fred, JD.
Dude, I'm the same way. Like, I'd like to see Koloko and give him some minutes. I'd like to see what a more entrenched Precious Achiuwa looks like, except that this is just where I'm at with that is I think that year over year you're going to be able to find center help, and you're certainly going to be able to find like guys who can step in who are big on flyer contracts that can give you some decent minutes at the rim. I'd be focusing on guards too. Like, to me, the great thing that this team is missing is point guard depth. And if we're talking about like sheltering Fred VanVleet or giving him those minutes off, well, unless the plan all of a sudden really shifts hard to the way that they change their viewpoint on Malachi Flynn, then I don't see how you can't be adding guards right now. So before you go, this will be the last one. Heading into free agency right now, is there a guard, is there somebody in particular that you think is a good target? Because you love your redraft candidates, right? Year over year, Blake Murphy loves his redraft candidates. Everybody pays attention to him. Who's the name? I don't care. Just one name that you're looking at right now as the above or ahead of the curve Malik Monk Hart. Like who is that person?
All right. So this is something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Thank you.
No yum, yum, yum today?
What, yum, yum, what's yum.
On? I haven't been on a 7 a.m. block in a while. Where's
Josh,
the...
Tough block.
So here's my one. And it's not quite the redraft candidate because he's not... The shine's not off of him this much. The Spurs didn't issue a qualifying offer to Lonnie Walker. So Lonnie Walker is now an unrestricted free agent. He is a good player who fits stylistically. He would add an element of athleticism that the Raptors' backcourt really hasn't had in a while. He's got the kind of size they look for in a guard at 6'4 with some good wingspan. He didn't shoot at all this past year. Like, his three-point percentage, he had been a three-point shooter and fell off a cliff. I would almost guarantee you the Raptors think they can fix that. He's not a perfect player, but you're shopping with the mid-level exception. You're not going to get a perfect player. I love Lonnie Walker's fit at the top of the guard kind of mid-level or just sub-mid-level tier. So that's your something that you want. Could Lonnie Walker be the guy? All this Raptors Spurs action all the time, and now you're gonna poach one of their free agents. There are enough connections between that franchise to chew on Lonnie Walker as an option.
Well, it fits a lot of the boxes, right? A guy with, like you mentioned, a ton of athleticism. He was somebody who I remember slipped in the draft a little bit when the Spurs grabbed him. I thought this is really going to work out. A little bit of fear that the Spurs would walk away from him because, again, I think that there's a lot to like about the player other than the shooting. But, yeah, I don't know. I thought that the Spurs were kind of in the same category, though, also with the Warriors of, like, we have the best shooting coaches. That worries me a touch. But you go get the kid from the U. He's still what, 23, 24?
Yeah,
he's,
23.
Yeah, like I don't know. That sometimes we get a little bit too enamored by age, but I actually think like when you're looking at the rest of this market, and especially considering like some of the names that I was looking at, going, I wonder if the Raptors are going to try to make a run at Raul Neto. That I'm more into Lonnie Walker Jr. in terms of the potential and the upside. Blake Murphy, thanks for making time. We'll talk to you for the Wake and Rake, pal. Congrats on Wake and Rake.
Yeah, talk to you at 8:30.
See you,
buddy. Oh, yeah, we won.
Yeah, we won. Correct. We always win. We're late for our next guest, Caleb Joseph, next on the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ailish, Sports at 5-9 of the Fan.
The smartest takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Happy almost Canada Day weekend. Our next guest is a Nashville guy, which we only know actually as like a place for bachelor and bachelorette parties right now. So even seeing like that's where he's from has given me like, you know, anxiety because of organizing these trips this summer. But I guess maybe he's going to get both. He's going to get to celebrate 4th of July in Canada Day. It's Caleb Joseph. What's up, buddy? How are we doing?
Doing great. And yes, you're right. We'll be celebrating both and excited and happy about it.
Have you ever been here for Canada Day?
I believe that I have been here as a player one time against the Blue Jays. I think they wore the red jerseys. I think it was a big deal.
Those are cursed. Yeah, those jerseys are cursed.
Yeah, the Jays.
They are.
Yeah.
They're like awful. I don't know. It's just a weird. It's such a weird thing to me. Like I know obviously why the organization does it because they make money and people like the red jerseys and people buy the red jerseys. So every once in a while they got to trot them out. And I actually do like them on Canada Day, even though they are cursed. Because I go, okay, this is the one time of year to do it. But I'm almost expecting. Remember when Chris Sale cut up those jerseys in the
when he
went with the scissors and they were like, oh, I guess we got to trade this guy because he's losing it. I keep expecting the Blue Jays to do one of those because the red jersey thing has been like dating back to, for a while now. We got Caleb Joseph on the line, former MLB catcher and current analyst for MLB us here at Sportsnet, which is great. You guys are absolutely killing it. I love when it's the two-man panel and you and Stittle get to chop it up. So I want to talk to you first about just if you're seeing something from the Jays in terms of their adjustments at the plate, because it was noted on the broadcast the other day that they went from being in the 20s to the top five in chase rate. And we're not talking about like a huge significant difference, something that you'd pick up if you saw it in the percentages. Like it doesn't go from like they're swinging at 25% less pitches outside the zone. Like there's small adjustments. And so this is kind of a two-parter, is that like, one, have you really noticed that watching them? And two, how much of that credit gets assigned to the hitting coach, Guillermo Martinez? Because I feel like this is a guy that we never talk about with the Blue Jays and their organization. And the hitting coach is usually only someone that you talk about when things are going poorly.
You're exactly right. And it's so easy to point the finger at the hitting coach when it's not going well. And those guys are usually the first guys fired, right? And so, yes, you've got to give credit to Guillermo Martinez. He has done such an amazing job to kind of get this offense back on track. And you make a great point in terms of their chase rate. And yes, it is absolutely noticeable that they are laying off a lot of pitches that earlier on in the season they would make offers at, and they were expanding. Now, don't forget, too, at the beginning of the season, they were facing some very, very good pitching. And good pitching usually makes those really close pitches look like strikes and end up finishing off the plate for balls. And so when you run through 2-3 weeks of those type of pitchers, it is easy to chase. And then you collectively, I guess, as a group, start to want to do more. And what happens is everybody tries to be the guy. And when you try and do more, then you're going to chase even more outside of the zone. But what has been happening that I've seen over the last 4 to 6 weeks, especially with the offense, is they have just been able to pass the baton. They've been able to take these really close pitches and really stay within. And I just love the approach in general. A lot of the Blue Jays hitters are kind of out over opposite field hitters that have the ability to pull the ball. And many of them have started to really utilize that opposite field. Lourdes Gurriel, Teoscar Hernandez, Bo is always in the top five in opposite field hits. And that just allows the ball to travel deeper in the hitting zone. And when it travels deeper in the hitting zone, you're able to see that ball a little bit longer and make a better decision. So a lot of it has to do with trust, with your stance and your hand placement and your hand positioning. And Blue Jays have been able to do it, and it's incredibly noticeable watching them on a daily basis.
So there's a whole bunch of guys like that you just outlined there, right? Like this does feel like very much a team effort. But you look at Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and his numbers the last month, he's back to being MVP Vladdy. You look at a little bit down the lineup, there are guys like Kevin Biggio who is having a bounce back. He's having a bit of a resurgence. Tapia has been better with this. Matt Chapman is somebody that Ailish and I were talking about just off air a little while ago as, wow, like when this dude is being like playing better, it really lengthens the lineup. Is there one guy in particular right now that you're looking at as kind of like your poster boy for these adjustments at the plate?
Well, I mean, Chapman's got a great eye to begin with, right? I just love the way that he approaches the game. He gives such a great at-bat at crucial times, and a lot of that for me sets up the guy behind him. Santiago Espinal has actually been really, really solid the entire season, kind of right in the middle of like a 3-for-41 or 42, had a couple really big hits last night. He's been super solid. Tapia, though, for me, is probably the number one guy, just in that he comes in to the season with a huge chase rate. He's one of the biggest chasers on the team. And as he has begun to play a little bit more, and you've seen his name in the lineup, he's producing, and he's right in the thick of a lot of the commotion that goes on with this Blue Jays offense. And I just love the element that he brings. I think it's a great position to have him in terms of being able to play 2 or 3, 4 times a week, potentially, depending on if certain guys need rest. And remember, he was a pretty much everyday guy in Colorado, and it's a really tough task to come over to a new organization and not play every day. And that first year that you're not playing every single day, it takes a minute to figure out your routines and how you can stay ready. And it's really, really hard to hit the big leagues. It's almost impossible to hit in the big leagues when you only play once or twice a week. But as he has found himself in the lineup more and more, he's really been a huge contributor. And I think watching his ABs and watching him zone up the strike zone has really allowed him to produce a lot this year so far.
So another question we were pondering, I guess the last couple of days with Berríos and Kikuchi about to get back in on the mound is, what for a catcher, like what kind of impact does it have if you're in a slump and as a pitcher and like you're matching up with a catcher? I mean, and the question here is there's two catchers, but there's going to be three. So does it matter as a pitcher and a catcher, that relationship to try to get you out of a slump, and how much impact as a catcher do you need to have on trying to get those guys in the right headspace?
Yeah, I think it matters. And I'm biased, obviously, because that was my position. And quite honestly, that was about the only thing I was really good at. Couldn't hit, could catch a little bit, called a decent game, but just connecting with those pitchers and trying to get the absolute most out of them. And you turn into a therapist sometimes. You become a professional massager, you know, where you're just trying to make these guys feel like they're on top of the world and make them feel like they're the best. But I heard a quote not too long ago, and I thought it was fantastic. You know, there's only 18 inches between a pat on the back and a kick in the rear, right? And so a lot of times that is what a catcher has to do. Sometimes you got to pat the guy on the back, and sometimes you got to kick him in the rear. And it's the fun part of catching. For me, it was the relational part, the fun part. But, yes, it absolutely matters. I feel like it matters. And when a pitcher knows that you're invested as a catcher, it just makes that much of a difference. And you've got to be able to try different things. And that only comes with trust. If the pitcher doesn't trust that you're invested with him, he might not want to throw that backdoor slider or that comeback two-seamer to a left-hander. But trying to get creative and find ways to help get guys through the game is one of the most fun parts of catching. Anybody can go back there and throw the right fingers down when, say, a Kevin Gausman has his good stuff or Alek Manoah is just pretty much just showing up every night and being himself. Those games are the easy ones. The fun ones are the ones where guys don't really have it and they could easily go two and a third or three and a third innings, and you as a catcher are somehow able to get them through five and two-thirds, save the bullpen. Those are where you really earn your money. But, yeah, it plays. It's important, and it's kind of like an art to figuring out how to do that. It takes a lot of experience, and most importantly, you have to know your pitcher.
I feel like those are going to be very important lessons and important parts to be in for the next 2 days, especially. Last one before we let you go, the Danny Jansen conversation's ramping up. He's, you know, at least probably a week or 2 weeks out coming back in the lineup. Do you have any more feelings on what the Jays will do with the three catchers or maybe what they should be doing, especially approaching the trade deadline?
Oh, great question. I don't really know. I haven't really talked to anybody. I just know that catching is so difficult to not only find, draft, but develop. And it looks like the Blue Jays have three very, very nice-looking catchers. I personally would like to see Moreno play a little bit more in AAA. I understand that they could potentially go with three up in the big leagues and let it roll. But, yes, Jansen coming back is going to be huge just in terms of that experience factor and being able to pair him maybe with the Berríos or, you know, maybe with a Kikuchi who you can try and allow some of that experience to play out and see if he can get some of these guys an additional one inning, two innings, goodness, maybe even throw six innings and less than three runs, a quality start for once, you know, for Kikuchi. But I don't know if I would be willing to trade those guys. I really don't. I think I've said it before, but there's might only be one person that I would trade one of our catchers for, and it might be Jose Ramirez of the Cleveland Indians. That's about like the only guy that I would trade one of these guys for because I feel so strongly about catching and how difficult it is to develop and how difficult it is to find catchers that can do both, that can really – catch and throw, call a good game, and can hit. Blue Jays seem to have three of them right now. Would be very leery of just trading them away. It's going to take a massive package for me to trade one of them away. But, yes, Danny Jansen comes back. I wouldn't mind seeing Gabby go down and play a little bit more in AAA and continue that development because I'm not sure really how he fits in once Danny gets back. Especially with Captain Kirk just flying the starship all over the world and can do no wrong. So we'll see how it pans out, but I would be so, so cautious to trade one of those catchers.
Oh, dude, you're 100% right. Like, the risk of it is insane, right? Like, catchers miss more than any other position in baseball when it comes to prospects. And I'm sure you can think of, like, countless guys that we all thought were going to be, like, a stud catcher. And then it was like, yeah, they had good big league careers or whatever, but it didn't pan out the way that you'd hoped it would. So being patient at that position, I got no issue with, you know, Gabriel Moreno. But I also look at it and say, well, but if he is this far along and he doesn't need, like, there becomes a question of like how much is he actually going to be helping the team? And so I agree. You cannot rush a trade like that. But if you feel like there's a move that can put you over the top and it involves one of those dudes, I think that Danny might end up being the name that they have to circle. The secondary kind of question off of it comes to how far along do you think Gabriel Moreno's defense is right now? Because, like, we can all see the arm when he throws to second and, like, he's thrown out, like, 4 or 9 base runners. But what do you see with all the other stuff right now so far? Has it impressed you?
Yeah, the offense is... has impressed me in terms of his ability to show up with 2 strikes and get hits in the big leagues. Yeah. That is really, really tough. One of the toughest things to do is to try and hit with 2 strikes. At least I found early on as a major leaguer, that was really difficult. A lot of these guys, just such amazing 2-strike pitches to strike guys out. For me, I do like his movements, his natural movements behind the plate. I like his hands. I do agree that he has a really, really fast transfer and a great, strong throwing arm. Physically, I don't think there's really any issues in terms of playing the game physically with the glove or the arm. For me, it's just the game calling, and there's nothing you can do really about it. You can sit and talk about it after the game or before the game, but trying to call a major league game just takes experience, and you've got to create so many experiences back there that nothing really phases or nothing really surprises you as a catcher, and it just takes repetitions. And, you know, I mean, what I think, only 100 games maybe behind the plate in his professional career. Remember, he was an infielder when the Blue Jays found him. So that's the part of the game that really kind of, for me, stands out a little bit. I mean, there was a couple games ago, did not repeat a fastball in his sequencing. And you take a veteran team like the New York Yankees, they're going to pick up on that in a heartbeat. And then you start to become predictable. I had a first base coach tell me one time when I was a first-year player in Baltimore. He said, they're not scouting the pitcher. They are scouting you. And I did not know what he was talking about until about 2 or 3 years into my career, realizing, oh, my goodness, I can easily fall into patterns with my game calling. And as a young player, some of these big-boy teams, Red Sox, Yankees, are going to figure that out, and they're looking more towards me as a young player than they are trying to figure out what that pitcher's doing, because I'm the one throwing the fingers down. So I think it's just going to take a little bit more experience, but tool-wise, he looks the part and is showing really well so far in his major league career.
Dude, that was really insightful. Thanks for sharing that today. We got to run, but enjoy your Canada Day weekend / 4th of July. Your double dip. Enjoy them both.
Perfect. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
See you, Caleb. Former MLB catcher, current Sportsnet analyst, Caleb Joseph. And that was really, really good, and that's going to be something that I reference for a while now. When we come back, rumors! Frank Saravelli. That's next. Fan Morning Show, JD Naylor, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.